Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I spoke to Mike Palank, general partner at Mac Ventures. We talked about in today's episode how diversity leads to outperformance, from talent management to tech, and why LA is more than just Hollywood, and how you get from acting to aerospace to logistics and beyond. And we also talk about gap closing versus gap widening. And the power of learning how to get comfortable with what if. This is an amazing episode. You're not going to want to miss it. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I am really excited to have with me Mike Palank. Mike is general partner at Mac Ventures, or Mac Venture Capital, an early stage fund focused on finding ideas, technology, and products that can be infectious. Mike, really great to have you here with me today.
All right, good to be here. Thank you.
So let's dig straight in. We talked a little bit about this on the primer episode, but I think, you know, for our listeners, a lot of whom will probably be sort of UK, Europe based, you know, we all talk about San Francisco, the Bay Area, Silicon Valley as being, you know, the center, the birthplace of venture in the US and globally to that extent. But can you talk me through the LA ecosystem and what makes it different and special from your perspective?
A lot of things. I love this ecosystem. I've been a part of it for over a decade. Certainly Silicon Valley is the birthplace of what we think of as the VC tech ecosystem, although there are some origins in New York and Boston as well. But I'd say the first thing that makes LA interesting is that it's a multi-industry town. And obviously, I think the first thing people think of when they think of LA is obviously Hollywood, which is, I think, the United States' biggest export is Hollywood product. And it's done a lot, you know, for our culture. So it's great, you know, it's great that LA is synonymous with Hollywood. But what people know less about is, you know, its history with aerospace and other things that I'll get into. But we'll talk about aerospace here. And the most valuable private company in the world, SpaceX, is based in backyard in Hawthorne, which I think people don't even realize that SpaceX is right here in LA, and in large part because the Apollo program roots are based in LA. A lot of the defense primes, Boeing, Raytheon, Northrop, you know, have either headquarters or large main offices here in LA, but there's a very rich and deep and long history in aerospace based in LA, and that originates in part from academia, Caltech, you know, which is here. People call it the MIT of the West. And a lot of interesting, like, radar technology, GPS technology originated at Caltech and made its way into the primes here in LA. So, you know, it's got this really rich history. You know, Houston, Texas is known as Space City. They've done a really good job at branding themselves. It's sort of, they become synonymous with space as LA's become synonymous with Hollywood. We haven't done, my opinion, as good of a job being known for our aerospace history, but it's here and it's present. And we have a lot of great companies established as well as startups in the space sector, aerospace sector here in LA. We also have one of the largest ports in the world. The Port of Long Beach is one of the largest ports in the world. We see enormous volumes of imports and exports coming through Long Beach, which will sort of just group Long Beach in with LA, Southern California. And so the import-export business, supply chain, logistics, it's a hub of that industry as well. You know, it's the global circulatory system of the world economy. You know, LA is a big part of that. I'd say, you know, fashion and culture more broadly, which maybe can be grouped into Hollywood, but LA is a culture hub. It's pumping out culture in the form of certainly movies, TV shows, music, fashion. It's known for that. So it's this multi-industry town. It's also a very diverse city in several ways, but racial diversity. If you look at sort of the racial makeup of LA, like most big cities, it's a very diverse city, certainly relative to Silicon Valley, which is much less diverse. And as you know, a lot of research has shown, diversity of thought, diversity of perspective leads to outperformance. And I think we are this melting pot of a lot of ethnicities and perspectives, and that benefits the ecosystem. So that's important. You know, there's always the weather, which people, you know, that's, that to me is an important part. You know, you're sitting in London, which maybe doesn't have the best weather. I used to live in Chicago that doesn't have the best weather when it's 70 and sunny, 80 and sunny most days in LA. That's a plus, you know, that's definitely a selling factor. And, you know, and then, you know, I think the thing that's certainly less well known that was sort of an eye opener to me when I found out is that LA or Southern California actually graduates more technical talent than Northern California. It's just historically, you know, that talent has migrated north, but just on a gross basis, we have more, you know, engineering, computer science students graduating each year down here than we do up in Northern California, the Bay Area. And so, yeah, we have a very, very strong base of technical talent, as well as, you know, financial and business development, sales talent, artistic talent. The knock on LA for a long time was, you know, you couldn't raise money here. You know, and then it was like, all right, we had a lot of seed firms pop up. It's like, oh, okay, you can raise your series seed round, but for A and later, you had to go to the Valley or elsewhere. And even that's changed. You know, you have Andreessen Horowitz. I think they have like several dozen people now headquartered here. And, you know, a lot of the bigger Silicon Valley firms either have an office or have, you know, a strong presence here. Lightspeed has a very strong presence here. So now that knock is gone too. You can raise pre-seed through, you know, IPO here in Los Angeles. So in my opinion, it's become one of the strongest, most important ecosystems anywhere in the world for all the reasons I've mentioned. But, you know, I think we're still on this kind of early innings growth trajectory, at least relative to Silicon Valley, which has been around, you know, since the 1950s, essentially.
Yeah. So leaving aside your clear bias to LA or Miami, which one would you pick?
Well, I mean, I think even if I was a neutral observer, just on objective facts, I would choose Los Angeles. I don't want to knock Miami, but yeah, I don't think it's the same kind of ecosystem at the same level. Maybe on Twitter it is, but of the other ecosystems. And it's, certainly it's a good ecosystem, but if I had to pick one as a better ecosystem to build, I would choose LA.
Yeah, no, I completely get it. So look, I mean, you touched on this, you know, this aspect of you know, the US's biggest export being sort of Hollywood and movies and so on. And LA, as you said, is synonymous with Tinseltown. You know, I think it's what most people kind of understand from it. And, you know, as we heard in your primer, you've spent a huge amount of time in that kind of talent industry and talent management industry. And, you know, even to the extent where you've represented Academy awardees, you've worked with Will Smith's production firm, et cetera. So, you know, and with William Morris Agency. So what are the parallels between venture capital in Hollywood, if any, and what can we learn? Because I've read somewhere, I can't remember where it was now, but you know, that early stage VC or VC when it was still a nascent kind of industry tried to emulate to some extent the way films were produced, and you know, the whole kind of production element of gathering, you know, various investors together and then, you know, backing a film and producing it and so on. So yeah, what are the parallels, if any, and what can you take away from the way Hollywood works into venture, or indeed not take away?
Well, I think, you know, whether you're building a company or, you know, creating a movie or a TV show, it does take a village. You know, you watch the end of a movie and you see credits that go on for 10 minutes and the hundreds, if not thousands, of people that were required to bring this movie to your screen. In the same way, you know, if you were to, if companies had a credit sequence post IPO, it'd probably be even longer, right? Yeah. All the people that were involved from the very first day to the IPO to get this company to where it was, you know, it does take a village. So at a very general level, there's that similarity. As we talked about earlier, you know, in Hollywood, the center of the universe are artists. They are the ones whose creations fuel the whole industry. You know, without them, talent agents don't have a job. Studio executives don't have a job. Truly, artists are the center of the Hollywood universe. And I think in the exact same way, you know, entrepreneurs in our world are the center of the universe. and everyone is in service of the entrepreneur. Just as in Hollywood, everyone's in service of the artist. And I think you can get into trouble if you think you're more important than the artist in Hollywood or more important than the entrepreneur in tech. And, you know, that was, I saw that sort of comp very early and clearly when I became a VC. I'm like, oh, I know this job. I did this job as a talent agent. And at Seed Stage VC, you know, most of our calculus in deciding if we should invest in a company centers around our determination of the quality of the founding team and the entrepreneurs. And often at Seed, certainly pre-Seed, there are limited data points to go off of. And it's way more subjective than objective, way more art than science, making this determination. Do we think this person or this team, you know, is great and can build a world-changing company? In the same way where I would go to the Sundance Film Festival back in 2005 and, you know, you go see this kind of art film and this person has like a 5-minute role and you're trying to determine, you know, can this person become a global movie star from this little seedling of a performance that I saw? Like very limited data points. And then you go meet with them, you have coffee with the artist, you see the kind of person what they are and their career ambitions and just how they see the world. And you're trying to determine, you know, from just limited data, you know, can I help turn this person into someone huge?
That famous star quality kind of aspect, right?
The star quality aspect, you know, and so that's very similar in these two worlds. And then at least in terms of VC and talent agents, like the competitive nature. So, okay, I determine that this person does have, at least my opinion, what it takes. Well, I'm probably not the only one. There's probably someone at three other agencies that feel the same way. And now we're all competing to sign this artist. And I'm selling myself now. The tables have turned. And like, here's why you should sign with me. Here's how I would help build your career. Here's why I'm the right person for you. Well, guess what? That happens all the time in the VC world where we're selling ourselves. I mean, capital is essentially a commodity. And, you know, founders, if they're great, often have options when choosing their VCs, and it's you know, why should I choose you? And so that was very similar to me. I wouldn't say it's a tried and true path from being Hollywood agent to venture capitalist, but certainly there are stories there of people that have walked that path. And you know, Mike Ovitz famously helped Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz sort of think through the structure and strategy of Andreessen Horowitz in the early days. And what they pursued was a very different model than was typical at the time in VC, just as when Mike Ovitz started CIA in the late 70s, it was a very different model than what was traditional in the Hollywood agency space at the time. And so, it's not a typical path. And I think some entrepreneurs, when they look at my LinkedIn, may say, oh, wait, why am I talking to you? You used to, you know, work with Forrest Whitaker and Will Smith and these people. And I'm like, well, actually, I just wanted to give them an abbreviated version of this story. And like, oh, yeah, there are similarities. I mean, I'm very proud of this path I followed.
I mean, and it's not just similarities. I mean, I guess, you know, both LPs as well as angels now. So if I think about, you know, you talked about Serena Ventures being involved in one of, you know, invested in one of the portfolio companies. Obviously, Serena's an athlete. Like one of my good friends over here is building a platform so that more athletes can invest in venture style deals. But I would imagine that, you know, to your point, movie stars, and you talked about Will Smith, you know, they have capital behind them. A lot of them want to do good. They want to, you know, make a difference in the world. They are often very outspoken people, right? With a lot of purpose behind them, often from quite humble backgrounds as well. And I would imagine that, you know, again, in terms of the ecosystem in LA and just tying those two things together, you know, that leads to potentially an abundance of potential partners, of advocates, of LPs, of funders, of investors, angels, etc., that come out of that ecosystem that, you know, want to do something good with their, you know, with their capital, you know, having, you know, built it up over many years and doing many movies. And presumably that's, you know, that's really positive as well, because, you know, the other thing I guess about Hollywood, at least, you know, from the outside looking in, is that otherwise it's quite a closed shop, whereas tech tends to be, you know, tends to express itself as being a very open and democratized kind of ecosystem, albeit that some people would argue venture is less democratized maybe than you know, the tech ventures that they're funding. But yeah, do you see that playing out, like a more and more artists, you know, film stars, movie stars, TV stars, et cetera, getting involved in the venture game?
Yes. I mean, so many. And this was, you know, I was at Overbrook, Will Smith's company. I think I started in 2010. Mm-hmm. And I forget exactly when Ashton Kutcher had launched his first venture fund. It was called A-Grade Ventures before it was called Sound Ventures. But you know, him and Guy Osiri raised outside capital. It wasn't just Ashton's or Guy's personal money. They raised a fund, GPLP structure. And, you know, like Robert Downey Jr. and Jared Leto and Snoop Dogg and Nas, like, you know, they had all started investing, but it was more personal money, family office money. Ashton was, from what I remember, is one of the few and earliest to actually launch a fund structure. And like, that's what I was wanting to do at Overbrook. I'm like, you know, like, yeah, we can invest the family's money, but let's actually create a fund. Let's raise outside capital. Because I think, you know, it makes you more disciplined when you have to report to investors and you have a certain, you know, performance threshold you have to hit if you want to keep raising money from those investors. And so I like that approach. You know, since then, a lot of funds, or a lot of celebrities rather than athletes, have raised actual funds, and even more have invested their personal capital.
I mean, most recently, I think Ivanka Trump, right, raised a private equity fund, if I'm not mistaken.
Ivanka Trump, Kim Kardashian.
Yeah. Oh, maybe it was Kim that I was thinking of, but there's a few.
You're seeing a lot of celebrity and athlete, and I'd say just creator, artist, celebrity in general, you know, some of these digital influencers, you know, raising actual structured funds. And like I said, even more. And it's almost like, you know, you haven't made it until you've figured out how to start investing in startups. It's sort of like it used to be, you know, you had a Rolls Royce, and now it's like, oh, you have a startup portfolio. Like, that's like the new I've made it sort of like milestone. And agents and managers have had to adapt. And, you know, it's hard for a talent representative to get into this game to help their clients with investing, because you know, you recommend an investment, it goes wrong, you could easily get fired, you know? So and you know, usually the reps don't participate in the upside of their client investing. So it's like big downside, maybe limited to no upsides. Like, why, you know? So they're still figuring out how to get involved and help their talent do it. But certainly I can help, you know, as a VC, you know, like bring them into deals, and there's no downside for me, and there's upside if a celebrity gets involved. They have a platform they can promote. They're often very smart. You know, what I admired about Ashton, and I, you know, I get asked a lot, like, you know, how do I set my artist up so they can have the most success in investing business? I'm like, one, it can't be a vanity thing. It can't be something that, you know, you have a team run. Like, Ashton went to the Valley often. He built his network. He met a lot of people. He made this part of his identity, not some vanity thing. And I think if you want to be serious about it and do it long term, that's the best way to do it, is really, as you know, the artist should be involved. The artist should spend the time, invest the time to meet the folks and not just outsource it to a team.
Which, to be fair, is, I guess, for anyone getting into kind of the venture ecosystem, whether as an angel, whether as an investor, whether as a founder, right? It's all about relationships, especially pre-seed, seed. You've just got to build those relationships, whether it's with talent, whether it's with, you know, your first senior hires, whether it's with your investors. Like, this is a people game, right? Like, there is no shortcut to investing at this stage. So changing tack for a second, right? So as some of our listeners may know, I run a CFO bench, right? We work with early stage venture-backed tech startups and scale-ups. And a large part of your career was spent in finance and operations. And I'm always curious, because there is, you know, there doesn't seem to be a straightforward on-ramp from that profession, which is relatively aligned to what happens in venture, what you do in venture, to venture. So what did you have to like learn, and more importantly, unlearn as you moved from finance operations to the investing side?
For sure. I was sort of a CFO or controller for hire for a while. And that was what I did. I helped early stage startups build financial models, think through fundraising strategy. I think at my heart, I'm an operation person. I think the best ops people are sort of utility players. You can wear a lot of hats, as you know, you often have to do at an early stage startup. And I can just get in. I always joke and say, I'm really good at Google. I can figure, if I don't know something, I can dive in and figure out at least enough to like be somewhat effective. And I think the best founders and early teams, you know, they have to do that. They have to do things they don't know how to do. They have to wear a lot of hats. And so I did that. You know, I did that for close to a decade, which certainly helps me now in a career in venture. I think, you know, what you have to unlearn, just as a quick story, when we were diligencing our launch company, Stoke, which I mentioned in the previous section, I went out and bought all the books that Elon Musk had bought, that Jim Cantrell had told him to buy and study when he was thinking about launching a launch business. And I bought these, and my partner Adrian, like, wait, do you think you can go and read and consume and understand 6 textbooks in the time frame we have to do this diligence? Like, no, absolutely not. I'm like, well, I do understand that, but as like a operator at heart, I tend to want to go deep and get super in the weeds. And at least when you're doing your diligence, you don't have that luxury often. And, you know, in the heat of the market of, you know, yesteryear, sometimes you had a few days, you know, to really decide it. It's like that was really hard on me, because I wanted to understand the business. I thought I was a co-founder before I got comfortable committing to an investment.
It's that ability to zoom out, right? Rather than go deep into the weeds. Yeah.
Right. And I had to kind of learn, one, I had to learn that it is more about the founder. Like, I don't need to understand the intricacies of how their product works to understand if this is a good investment. Really, at least at seed, it's about understanding the founder. And that's a different, you know, set of diligence questions and process. I'll give credit to my partner, Adrian Fenty, to really focus me in on that, because he's very good at that. Mm. And so I sort of had to learn to zoom out and look at different things. Now, I still, and we'll probably always like getting in the weeds, and post-investment, of course, you have plenty of time to go as deep as you want, especially if you're on the board. You should go deep, in my opinion. But that was something that I had to get better at, having been an operator and, you know, spending most of my time in the weeds. Kind of started my career in the hedge fund space and working with publicly traded companies. I gave a kind of a talk to some USC students a few weeks ago. It was a valuation class. And I started the class saying, I'm probably the worst person for you to speak with, because I'm going to tell you about how I value companies and you're going to laugh, because it's like, you know, it's very much like, okay, which way is the wind blowing? And like, there's no DCFs, there's no EBITDA to discount back to the present. Like, just that doesn't happen.
It's what I always say at pre-seed and seed: valuation is something you negotiate, not something you set, right? Like, every time I see a deck that comes through with a, we're raising X at a Y valuation, I'm like, well, that might be what you think you're doing, but you know, both those numbers could change quite dramatically by the time you get out of this.
Right. It's leverage. It's how hot is your round? You know, obviously at seed, I think founders are looking to sell 20 to 25%, no more. So that sort of becomes the starting point. And it's like, how much heat do you have? How much progress do you have, don't have? And that determines the negotiation. And so, you know, it did remind me when I came from a hedge fund, started working at a talent agency where we had to basically, we were selling and pricing people. You know, it's like you sell an actor for a role in a movie and they want to hire them. They're like, all right, how much do I have to pay? And it was completely subjective. And I'd come from this world where I was doing detailed modeling and DCFs to figure out the value of a company. And then I'm like, you know, how do you value a person's time? How do you, you know, and it was mostly like, oh, what did they make on the last movie? How did that movie do? You know, let's bump it up or down, depending on were they in a magazine? Did they get some covers? How big is their Twitter following? Whatever. And I'm like, this is crazy. This is like so subjective. And there's no like mathematical reasoning to how we're picking these numbers. And I had to get comfortable with that. And that certainly served me well as I was getting into VC. And the same thing was like, why is this company valued at this or that? Like, just, you know, way more subjectivity and much more of a negotiation. And fortunately, I didn't have to unlearn a lot because I had the experience at the talent agency becoming comfortable with that sort of subjectivity. So,
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And I definitely see echoes in my own kind of style of how I've approached, angel investing. It's really, being able to look at a deck and get a feel for the founder and the market and the product without focusing too much on all the other noise that's in the deck, right? Like, it's why I often find financial models that pre-seed seed, to be kind of a bit silly, I guess, when they're asked for, because, they are just so, they are so subjectively kind of prepared because there's just no data to go on, right? But I think, one of the things that it's really important, we talk to a lot of operators turned investors on this podcast. I think it's that balance of having the experience to understand what are the kind of milestones and challenges that the founder is going to face along that journey, and therefore being able to provide that direction without, to your earlier point, trying to become a co-founder in the business, right? Your role is to direct and to provide governance, maybe to some extent, but, to provide solutions where they have problems, but without dictating those solutions to them, right? Like, it's providing them a set of options that they may be able to follow to get out of Dodge.
And there's this paradox where, going back, I want to understand a business to a pretty granular detail when I'm doing my diligence, and I want to ask a lot of questions and study the market. But I feel like it's seed or certainly pre-seed. Like, the more you dig, the more like potential red flags you're going to find, the more reasons not to like the deal you're going to find. And you spend 2 weeks digging and you may talk yourself out of backing a really amazing founder. And that was something my partner Adrian really sort of like said to me, is like, you go so deep and you talk yourself out of doing these investments that, at the surface, when you first met them, you're like, this is great. And you're going to find the more you dig on most companies we see, like, the more reasons not to do a deal. And our job is to really look at, what if this all goes right?
Yeah.
Like, what does this become? How big has this company become? I try to like figure my way through that, where this desire to go deep and understand everything while not talking myself out of backing a great founder. It's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, I love that. It's actually like learning to get comfortable with that what if, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about Mac Venture Capital for a second. So Mac is an incredibly diverse fund, right? And we talked about this a little bit earlier. Both of the managing general partners are African-American. The team has a huge amount of diversity, both in ethnicity and gender. You joked yourself that you're the token white guy. And I think I joked to you, I managed to find, the one white male on the team when we first spoke. And I say that purely in jest. How does that but not only actually gender and ethnicity, but also in terms of experience, right? As you mentioned, you come from like a huge variety of backgrounds. So how does that inform the way that you invest and how you're able to invest and support founders? And especially thinking about, you mentioned you have portfolio companies now in Africa and LATAM, like, that diversity, I think, obviously is a superpower as far as I'm concerned. How do you think about the way that you use that diversity when you're looking at portfolio companies and supporting them?
Yeah, I think a few ways. One, maybe kind of falls into this idea of pattern matching that, VCs talk a lot about.
Yeah.
And I think, when people typically talk about pattern matching, it's, a certain type, Adam Neumann or Steve Jobs or, someone that dropped out of Stanford or came out of Silicon Valley or came out of Google. Like, typically, there's a pattern matching type that I'd say the majority of VCs match to. Mm-hmm. And what we hope, is in play at Mac is that we're pattern matching maybe to that type in part, but also different types, because we've seen success in other types of people. Maybe a single mom who's, worked her way through a tech career, raising two kids, who starts a company and achieves some success as a bootstrap business. Like, there's some grit and determination in that. And, we'd like to pattern match to different types of people. I think it's close to 80% of our companies have at least one immigrant founder. Mm. And, you know, immigrants are a very dynamic, strong group, generally speaking. A lot of them come over here and they burn the boats. Like, we have to find success in this country. There's no other option.
This is it for us. Yeah.
This is it. And people back home are just, you know, relying on us. Success is the only way forward. And, you know, if you come from a wealthy family, and I'm totally generalizing here in the United States, and like, you got safety net upon safety net, you don't have that kind of burn the boat, I have to succeed at all cost mentality. And it's not to say people that come from wealthy backgrounds, often they have that too. I need to make my own way. I got to get out of my mom or dad's shadow, and that drives them. But immigrants, I think a lot of them have this, you know, succeed or nothing kind of mentality. And that really drives them. Every founder is going to hit multiple obstacles, and just, you know, it's a tough road. And immigrants, I think, on the whole, are very good at pushing through. And so we like pattern matching to different types of founders. So I think that comes into play as, and, you know, one thing that we say when we look at companies, or, you know, kind of how we look at the world of opportunity, and I think we took this from the K4s, Mitch and Frida, but, you know, looking for companies that are gap closing versus gap widening, that are, you know, kind of democratizing access to something, you know, building something that's for, you know, let's say, you know, the 99% or certainly the 50+% versus a smaller segment of the population. So, you know, I don't think you'll see Mac investing in a company helping sell high price handbags, yeah, you know, direct to consumer. Like, not that those businesses are bad, but I think, and not that all of our companies will fit this profile, but we do like businesses that are looking to democratize access to something. And often the person starting those businesses is someone that didn't have access, yeah, originally, and they're driven by this need to give to others what they didn't have for a long time. And we really respond to those types of businesses. And often those people are from underrepresented backgrounds or communities. And so we think that's, you know, important. And, you know, as a steward of capital and helping push certain companies or industries forward, we think that's a great responsibility and important thing to do, is look for companies like that, to provide more access to more people around the country and around the world.
Yeah. I mean, look, it makes a huge amount of sense to me. I mean, you know, the point about migrant immigrant founders, like, you know, the statistics are out there. I don't have them to hand, but, you know, they tend to be, you know, a high proportion of successful businesses are founded by migrant founders. You know, we see lots of immigrant CEOs in the larger tech businesses at the moment, you know, and a lot of them from India, seemingly. But there is, I think, to your point, there is that hunger, that there is that kind of, you know, make or break mentality that a lot of them have, because, you know, I spoke to someone that came in this morning to record the pod. You know, she came from New Zealand to the UK, bought a one-way ticket, self-funded herself through her an MBA, and basically landed up here with no relationships, no network, no money, and just hustled away through to doing what she's doing now. And I think it is that kind of hustle mentality that a lot of migrant founders had. And your point around, you know, the pattern matching, and I guess, you know, that's where pattern matching stops becoming pattern matching, to the extent that, you know, if you think about the way a lot of investments have been made in the past, the pattern matching has been, okay, you know, the alum from this school with this background, you know, from born and raised in this area, they're going to get a big tick, versus, to your point, the mother with two kids, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, the more you go down the route of diversifying that pattern matching, the less it actually becomes about pattern matching. And it's actually about outliers, right? So actually, it's potentially those that don't fit those traditional patterns are more likely, yeah, or potential, yeah, to get investment than the others. Listen, Mike, just as we close off, you know, the podcast is called Nothing Ventured. I loved your story during the primer about sending out the letter, cold, and getting the call, and then basically backing yourself, you know, jumping on a plane after 12 months and moving to LA sight unseen. And this podcast is all about that, right? It's all about how we can take those first steps in our journey, you know, what it means to back yourself and how do you move forward. So for people kind of who want to enter the LA venture ecosystem, whether they're founders, whether they're investors, what's kind of one piece of advice that you would give to them? Because I assume that LA is a large ecosystem, you know, or it's certainly a large city, right? Like, how do they navigate that? What is the best thing that they could do as a first step?
Well, I mean, for step one is to do what Sam Haskell told me to do, which is hop on a plane and come here sight unseen, you know? So I think you have to be in the ecosystem. You have to go to the events. You have to see the participants in this ecosystem firsthand and build the relationships, founders, investors, people in Hollywood, people in supply chain, get to know them. There's, you know, LA is great weather. We like going out. We like doing social things. So there's no shortage of opportunities to build relationships here in LA. And so that, you know, that's here, be here, get to know people, you know, and then, you know, I'd say if you can lean into the industries, whether it's media, technology, gaming, you know, or supply chain logistics, aerospace, fashion, you know, if you're building a biotech company, I mean, not to say you can't do it here, but, you know, like you might have higher odds of success building that kind of company in a different ecosystem.
Sure.
Maybe that's too general, but like, you know, I'd say to increase the odds of success, you know, build a company here that, you know, that LA is known for having a strong ecosystem in. I think it's pretty simply those things. It's come here, get to know the participants, you know, I think build in an area where, you know, LA is known for, and, you know, we have a great sort of infrastructure of talent, you know, investors, history that you can tap into to increase the odds of your success. I think, you know, that's very simply what to do.
And I guess that advice really goes for pretty much, you know, any ecosystem you're getting into. But I think, you know, to your point, LA has such a diversity of opportunities, right? Diverse industries, you could essentially enter kind of any of those spheres. To your point, maybe not a biotech business, but, you know, the world is kind of your oyster, and it's about making those connections and finding your place within that ecosystem, right? Without sort of coming in with preconceptions about, you know, who you are, what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think in any business, and certainly in venture and tech, like, relationships are so much. And, you know, I think the founders that, you know, even if you're an introverted technical founder, I mean, you need to always be building investor relationships. You need to be building relationships with potential talent. You need to be nurturing the relationships inside your own company, partner relationships, customer. I mean, it is always a relationship building game 24/7. And again, a great reason why LA is an amazing tech city is that, you know, people are used to that. I thought it's a 24/7 city. It's not New York. It's not like that. Like, LA relative to New York, I'd say, is a little bit sleepier in that, you know, it isn't not a 24/7 city. But, you know, this idea of business and pleasure is completely blended in LA. And there's no 6 o'clock, punch the car, go to the family, have a bar. It's like, no, your business and social lives are completely intertwined here, for better or for worse. But come here and take advantage of that and build out your network. And I think you'll see it's an amazing, amazing place to build.
Awesome. And so, talking about network and relationships, for our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where's the best place for them to connect with you?
All the above. LinkedIn, Twitter, MPalink101 on both. That's my handles. I try to post on both frequently. Try not to be an obnoxious VC poster, but be authentic to who I am. And, you know, share things that I find interesting, that are important to me, that I think would be interesting to other people. My email is mike@macventurecapital.com. You know,
amazing. Thank you so much, Mike, for joining me here today. It's been a lovely conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
I loved it. Thank you.